This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
5 a.m., I'm up with a crisp Celsius energy drink. Running 12 miles today. Grab a green juice, quick change, and head to work. Meetings, workshops, one more Celsius, no slowing down. Working late, but obviously still meeting the girls for a little dancing. Celsius. Live. Fit. Go. Grab a cold, refreshing Celsius at your local retailer or locate now at Celsius.com.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need. From athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist. Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
Welcome to the Missouri Woods and Water Podcast. I'm your host, Nate Thomas, flying solo yet again. Micah and Andy are pieces of human garbage, and I'm just by myself, I guess, forever. But today's show is awesome. Was really excited about this show. Every time I talk to Lindsey Thomas Jr. with the Deer Association, I learn something new. And so today we talked to Lindsey about his recent article, 12 Signs You Should Harvest More Does, and it was a good read, and it just made me think a lot about it, so I decided to have Lindsey on the show. Every time I talk to him, you know, I feel like I get smarter, so it's a great show. Lindsey, you know, does a good job breaking down the article. If you want to read the article, go to deerassociation.com/articles, and you can find it, or just Google 12 Signs You Should Harvest More Does, and you'll find it. It'll take you right to it. So that is the premise of today's show, and we'll get right into it after we get through our sponsors. Want to get into our sponsors. First, I want to start off with Black Ovis. If you have not entered our $2,000 Black Ovis giveaway yet, I don't know what the hell you're doing. It's easy to do it, and you can win up to $2,000 worth of stuff from blackovis.com. It's $1,500 in Black Ovis gear, and then $500 just to the website for anything. One winner will be drawn on October 15th. So you have until now, until then, to enter. Easy to enter. Go to blackovis.com/giveaways, or go to our website, missouriwoodsandwater.com. Go to our partners tab, and right under Black Ovis, you'll see a link to it. We've got a link to it on our Instagram page. We'll put stories out periodically that have a link to it. Really should not be difficult for you to find how to enter this giveaway. All you got to do is give your name and your email, and you're entered. Simple to enter, and there will be one winner. So good luck to everybody. Hope it goes to good use. If you, if and when whoever our listener is that wins it, if you want to get a hold of us and ask us what we like, we're happy to help you with that Black Ovis gear, man, because they've got some cool stuff. So check them out, blackovis.com. If you don't win, use our code MWW10 for 10% off on the website on anything, and that includes sale items. Camo Fire, check out the Camo Fire app. Get that daily deal. Especially this time of year, I like to buy stuff. So Camo Fire gets used quite a bit. Onyx, use our code MWW20 for 20% off. Love those guys out there. Go support them, or we support them. Check out their stuff. Go to the website, use the code, and save yourself 20%. Athlon Optics, planning on having a show with them about rifle scopes at some point in the near future. Need to reach out to our boys there and check it out. Alps Outdoors, use our code 2024 Woods Water for 30% off. That is an awesome deal right there. Huntworth Gear, use our code MWW15 for 15% off. And this would be the time to kind of start worrying about when it gets colder. That heat boost stuff comes in clutch. Zamberland Boots, ZamberlandUSA.com. I just got a pair of cold season, cold weather boots. I do not remember the name of them. Next time we have our Zamberland spot, I will make sure to remember the name of them. I'm pretty stoked about them. They seem like they're going to be pretty warm. Reveal Cameras by Tacticam. I've got a bunch of them out now. I actually just canceled one that is having some issues with some moisture in the lens. Called customer service, and they sent me an RFA. I'm going to send it in. They're going to check it out and get it fixed for me. So until I can get out there to the woods, I canceled it because it's dead anyway. So might as well save some money. And then Habitat Works, man. Call our buddy Dustin, 816-752-7390. Mention us when you call. Get 15% off any of his services. Dustin is a wealth of knowledge in all kinds of stuff with land and land management. And he also is now an agent selling land and stuff like that too. So give him a call. That is our sponsors for today. Let's get into our show with Lindsey Thomas Jr. of the Deer Association about harvesting does. This is the Missouri Woods and Water Podcast. Okay, with me today, got Uncle Lindsey back. We know that's not true, but man, it's a running joke with us now when you have you on the show. So Uncle Lindsey's in the house again.
Thank you, Cousin Nate. I appreciate you having me back.
I don't know how that works. If I call you Uncle Lindsey and you call me Cousin Nate, is that just something, you know, like a Southern thing we got to worry about down the road? You know, we had some sisters, a sister and brother got together at some point, sounds like.
Yeah, how about we just both be cuz, because okay. Uncle Lindsey makes me feel ancient.
Makes you feel old? All right. Yeah, I'm an uncle now, and my niece and nephew, they call me Uncle Nene. And so it makes me feel a little younger because it's like a little cool sounding nickname, but otherwise I feel older that I am an uncle. So it is what it is, I guess, right?
Right.
Someday I'll be a grandpa. Whew, it's coming.
I had an uncle. I never knew him because I was three when he passed away, but his name was Lindsey Grace, and that is where the name Lindsey comes from. My father was named after him, so he's kind of my great uncle. So when we talk about Uncle Lindsey, that's who I'm picturing is, an old man. And so, yeah.
Yeah.
Let me just be cuz.
All right, cousin Lindsey. So, this is at least the fourth time we've had you on the show, maybe more than that. We like doing shows with NDA. Y'all put out great content when it comes to the education of, hunters and, being stewards of the land. Obviously NDA and QDMA, it wasn't NDA at the time, it was something else. But anyway, they came together some years ago, and now I don't even remember the two different, sides of the two different organizations. Now it's just NDA. So, you know, National Deer Association. For the listeners, if you don't know what they are, look them up. The National Deer Association is one of the, you know, greatest conservation-minded organizations we have for whitetail hunting out there. So check them out if you haven't. And but particularly today's topic, right before season opens here in Missouri and pretty much around the country, maybe, you know, the South, it's a little bit further away. Although I'm guessing season might open soon, but the rut is further away for some folks. But, you know, we're right around the corner here in Missouri. September 15th is when our season's open. So, you know, we got less than a month, a couple weeks until the season opens. So I read this article that you put out a few days ago. I don't remember exactly how many days ago, but it's been very recent, called The 12 Signs You Should Harvest More Does. And that's a perfect time for this topic because there are a lot of folks that worry about, you know, shooting does. I mean, the three of us on our podcast are that way. Andy's got a farm where, you know, he worries about not having enough does. And, you know, I've got another farm where I barely see any does and I worry that I don't have any or enough to, you know, bring bucks in. So this is a perfect time to talk about this topic. A lot of people are thinking about whether they should or, shouldn't kill does. And this is a great time to talk about it. So let's do a 30,000-foot view of the article first, and then we'll get into the, you know, the guts of it. But what made you think about writing it?
Yeah, it's a perennial question that we get and always has been is, should I take does? And if so, how many? It's something that a lot of hunters do think about, like you're talking about. And the fact is there are a lot of simple signs out there that you can go by and indicators that'll tell you whether, you know, where you are. It's difficult to come up with any set number for anybody and say, you ought to take this many, because it's never, you know, there's never a precise point you're trying to hit. Deer populations are always fluctuating. So it's more about sort of reading the signs that are out there all the time and having your finger on that pulse and adjusting as you go, increasing or decreasing doe harvest as you need to sort of stay in that zone. And that's what we wanted to help folks with is, you know, rather than we can't tell everybody you ought to take this number of does because it's different for every hunter in every location. But there are indicators you can be watching, a lot of them, that can help. And then, you know, the other thing too is, as I wrote last year, over the last couple of years, we're starting to see a national decline in harvest of antlerless deer. That's a little concerning to us. We're getting back to a point nationally where we're taking more antlered bucks as, you know, a nation than we are antlered deer. That's not a good direction to go in. And there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, the continuing decline of hunter numbers. There's just fewer hunters out there. A lot of us are busy. We get a buck in the freezer, and maybe that's enough venison for people for the year. The stats are showing that, you know, only about 41% of all deer hunters take a deer. So that means, you know, almost 60% of deer hunters out there don't take a deer each season. And only about 18% of us take more than one deer in a season. So it's clear that, you know, and deer processors will tell you this, that, you know, fewer people are taking multiple deer and putting them in a freezer or donating them or sharing them. And the other factor here is deer processors are declining. The availability of deer processors is on the decline. And so it's just not as easy as it used to be to get a deer processed. For all these reasons, you know, we're seeing signs that people are taking fewer does, that there are fewer hunters to take those does. And that's why we've kind of made it a national priority for this organization to say, hey, we can't let this drop. We have to keep up with doe harvest where we hunt for a lot of reasons, mostly because that's a key factor in deer population health, a key factor in our success and satisfaction as deer hunters. And so we're just trying to encourage folks to stay on top of this and remember their responsibility to take an adequate number of does where they hunt. Adequate might be zero, adequate might be a lot, and it varies. And so we just want to help folks be able to tell where they hunt, how many should they be taking.
Yeah. One, and another thing I think we could do a better job of, and me as a dad, I think I definitely need to try to do this year, is I've got two. I'm hunting for three. I've got myself and two sons that hunt, and they both have gotten to where they're talking about, you know, what buck am I going to get this year? You know, is, you know, should I wait for a bigger one this year? I think maybe I've even done a bad job as a dad saying, you know, it's just as cool to kill a doe as it is a deer with antlers growing out of its head. You know, a 6-year-old doe is really hard to kill, you know, really, really hard to kill. Some would say harder to kill than a 7-8-year-old buck. So, you know, maybe doing a better job teaching the younger ones that does are awesome too. It's really cool to see a doe be smart. And, you know, it might be something I try to do a better job of this year is like, hey, let's kill what is important to us, which is a deer, not a buck. It is a deer. And, yeah, I mean, because you're right. We all get that, those googly eyes for the antlers. And, I mean, and I see it all the time. You don't see a lot of pictures of does on Instagram and Facebook. You see a bunch of bucks. You know, people don't seem as proud as they would be as they are with a buck. So, yeah, it's a good point. But the article itself has a lot of good information in there, that things I didn't even think about or have never thought about when it comes to paying attention to the fact that you should probably harvest more does outside of the reason that they're deer just the same and they probably eat better than a buck does, right? We all know that. They seem to taste sometimes a little better. So, although I've never noticed a difference, but other people say they do. But anyways, let's just start with out on the article and talk about, you know, the different points you made, and we can kind of go through it the way you wrote it or however you feel like doing it, really.
Yeah, you tell me. We can go point by point, or whatever. And I think that's a great point you made about valuing doe harvest. You know, last year I killed a doe that cementum aged 9.5.
Wow.
The year before I killed a doe that cementum aged 8.5. And those were two of the most tense and exciting hunts I've ever had. It's a challenge to take an adult or especially mature doe like that. So, and yeah, they're, I had some venison last week from my 9.5-year-old doe and been eating on that along and along. Mm-hmm. It's delicious, still delicious. You know, most of the factors that go into how your venison tastes have more to do with how you handle and process the deer and process the venison than with the age of the deer. So, you know,
yeah,
whether it's a mature buck or a mature doe, I enjoy eating the venison. Never had any problem with being able to tell from the venison that, oh, this was an older deer, because I, you know, follow the same protocol and etiquette for
right
processing and handling the venison, cooling it off, getting it processed soon, aging it in a cooler on ice at the right temperature, you know, and how you field dress the deer, making sure you don't get gut contents on the meat while you're doing that. You know, there's so many steps
yep
that ensure good quality venison, and so I have no hesitation enjoying the venison from a 9.5-year-old doe.
Yeah, and that's why I said I've really never noticed it. I killed a buck several years ago now, who I gut shotted him with an arrow with a bow, and so I let him sit all night long. The next morning we go back, so of course all night long I'm worried about the meat going bad because it was probably in the 50s. In November at that time, just had one of those hot Novembers, and I'm like, I'm going to lose all this meat. This is going to suck. Great. Go find him the next morning, first thing. And he had just died within the last 2 hours. I mean, he was still warm, everything, you know, there's still steam coming out of his cavity, and, he still tasted great. You know, I was worried about spoilage or him not tasting very good because I gut shotted him and all these things that you worry about. And that was one of the better eating deer I've had in a long time. So I think sometimes, yeah, you're right, just how you field dress them and how quickly you get them to processors and cool them down. I was worried about him, but he still was awesome. So, yeah, let's just go through the article the way you wrote it and kind of talk about each point and, you know, give it to the listener in that fashion.
So the easiest one, and this was the first point I started with, is, you know, how many does have you harvested in the past? Because over time, a very good guideline to go by is just take a doe for every buck you harvest. And that will kind of, if everybody, you and the people you hunt with on a particular property are all taking a doe every time for it, you know, at least one doe for every buck you harvest, that'll keep you out of trouble with things like buck to doe ratio, and generally keep you out of trouble with deer density. Now, if you are in a high deer density situation, if you see some of these other signs we'll talk about that you've got a whole lot of deer and not enough food for them, then you might need to step it up a little in that area and take two per buck or more until you get caught up. But in a balanced situation across time, if you're taking a doe for every buck you harvest, you're going to stay in good shape and pretty much not have a lot of trouble. So that's the simplest one, is how to know. If you look back over the last few seasons and got a bunch of bucks on the wall and a bunch of punched buck tags and no doe tags to show for it, no does in the freezer, maybe you need to step it up a little. And, you know, hey, if you go a season with a couple of does and no bucks, it won't hurt anything until you get caught up. So, yeah, take a doe for every buck across your career and you'll be fine.
Because if I remember correctly, I think we've talked about this before, in general, there's no stats that show that you're going to have more bucks born than fawns or than does. You're going to have about half and half over the life span. To, you know, over a 10-year span. So, you know, taking a doe for every buck makes sense. Take one. One and one are probably going to replace it next year, you know, or as they are born. So, I mean, that makes the most logical sense that anybody could kind of really make the argument for, right? I mean, you're not, in theory, you're not going to hurt numbers. Born, yeah.
No. Fawns are born at a 50-50 ratio, pretty much, you know, maybe a little bit to one side or the other, but not enough to make a difference.
Right.
So there's that correction every spring with the fawns that sort of corrects your sex ratio. And from an adult deer management standpoint, it's when everybody goes out there and gets their buck or two bucks or, you know, whatever each season and doesn't take does, that we get toward a situation of imbalance where you've got your buck to doe ratio favors does.
Yeah.
And so it's just a matter of, you know, sometimes it can work both ways. If you've really been hammering the bucks, backing off on the bucks, letting a few of the younger deer go to reach some age and increasing your doe harvest can, you know, quickly get you back to a balanced sex ratio. It's when we really hammer the bucks and don't take does that things become imbalanced and stay that way.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a solid way to start the article for sure. All right.
So the next point that I made was having to do with rattling and grunt calls. If those techniques don't work for you, if you're out there in November or whenever the rut peak is where you hunt and you try grunt calls and you try rattling antlers and nothing ever responds, that can be a sign, not always, but can be a sign that you've got a lot of does out there and not many bucks. And what's going on is bucks don't have to compete for breeding opportunities. The whitetail rut is a scramble for them to see how many does they can breed in a short window of time. And so when there's a whole bunch of estrus does out there and they can just kind of breed one, and when they're done there, move on and travel a short distance and encounter another one, they don't have a need to compete. Things like fighting and chasing and grunting, those come from competition when you have roughly balanced buck to doe ratios, and bucks have to compete with each other to be the next in line and to find the next estrus doe and, you know, compete to be the one that she's going to tolerate. All that competition comes from a balanced buck to doe ratio. So rattling and grunt calls, bucks respond to that because they have to compete. Oh, that might be a fight over there over an estrus doe. That might be a buck grunting and chasing an estrus doe. I better go check that out because that might be my opportunity. So response to those calls comes from a sense of competition. The competition only comes when buck to doe numbers are balanced. So when those calls don't work, and this is speaking from experience, on our home, my family's land in Southeast Georgia, years ago, it used to be that you could rattle till you were blue in the face and grunt all day, and nothing ever responded. It was only after we started taking an adequate number of does and protecting 1 and 2-year-old bucks like we do and getting them into some older age classes that those things started working for us, and they still work today. You know, you can expect Not always, not 100% of the time can you grunt a buck in or rattle, but at the right times of year, particularly the pre-rut for rattling and particularly the peak of the rut for grunt calls, you've got a good chance of getting a response from a buck with those techniques where before there was zero chance.
Yeah, I kind of look at, when I read that part of the article, my wife is in the middle of watching The Bachelorette. Now, I'm sure you know what that show is. And there's another one called The Bachelor, where it's a dude. And you think about it, when it's the chick, when it's the bachelorette, there's a bunch of guys going for her. So they're all kind of fighting over, right? Because there's only one lady. And then when it's the bachelor, when it's just one guy and a bunch of girls, he doesn't have to do anything. He just, they're all trying to get him, which I know is a little different with deer, but it kind of makes sense if you think about it that way. And, I'm trying to do a better job of sitting down and watching stuff with my wife instead of like just going into the other room. I don't like the show, but I'm trying to do a better job, and I end up just making fun of it and she kicks me out anyways. But when I'm watching, I'm just sitting there like, this is hilarious. It's, you know, a bunch of guys fighting, you know, over some lady. So it's the same thing in the deer woods. If there's just one lady and all them bucks, yeah, that makes sense. They're going to fight. They're going to take those opportunities. But if there is a million does out there, well, why would they fight when we can all just have what we want? You know, there's plenty of them out there at this point. So that makes a lot of sense.
That's right.
A lot of sense for sure. And makes you wonder, like, obviously not all bucks are going to respond every time you grunt or rattle. And it might not necessarily mean that you don't have enough does or have too many. But it could. And so that's something to consider.
It's a positioning thing.
Yeah.
You got to be in the right place at the right time, you know, with that. Just like the rut, the way the rut works, you can be in a position in a particular stand and have the best day you've ever had deer hunting and see tons of activity where 100 yards away, somebody in another deer stand thinks the rut isn't even happening.
Right.
That's just the way this works. You got to be in the right place at the right time, and sometimes it's random and difficult to predict. Same thing with grunt calls and rattling. If you're not near the center of action where things are going on at the right time, no, they're not. You're not going to get a response. So, it's not always, and it's not 100%. But
yeah,
If your buck to doe ratio is imbalanced, they're not going to be effective anyway, no matter where you are.
Yeah. And there are a lot of people out there that know their properties and know where the bedding is. They know where they come from. They know where they're at. So if you're not getting those responses, that's something to consider. I know where the deer are at. I know where the does are bedded. So if I'm not getting responses, is it because we're not rutting yet, blah, blah, blah? Or is it because they don't need to worry about it? So they don't. That's a solid point, because we've all had those days where we rattle, and I like to call. I enjoy rattling. I enjoy grunting. Micah would say I overcall, but whatever. And you get you rattle and you get them just coming, you know, hard. And then there's those other days you know you do it every half hour or whatever, and you never see anything all day, and you're just like, well, okay, maybe he's right. Maybe I do overcall, but. So yeah, that's just another thing to consider when you're out doing your calling, your rattling, your grunting, whatever you do. It could mean more than just things that normally we would think about as hunters. That's another layer that we really should start considering. So another solid point. All right, what's the next point? Let's see, was that the second one?
That was the second one. The third one was browse lines, which is an interesting one to me. Browse lines, for those that don't know, you've probably seen this. You might see it on the edge of a cow pasture or a goat pen or something like that, where trees overlap into where you got livestock, and the livestock would have browsed those limbs. And, you know, it looks like a razor went along and trimmed off the tree limbs as high as the animals can reach. Well, deer can do this too in the woods. And it's interesting to me how easily most people overlook this when it's right there. They're just not looking at that. People will send me trail camera pictures of nice deer and be like, check out this buck. And in the background, I'm seeing a browse line for days. And I want to say, wow, you have got a terrible browse line in the woods. You got a bad situation there. That's what I'm seeing, and they're looking at the buck. I think that's what, you know, happens to many people. They're out there in the woods looking for deer, looking for scrapes, looking for rubs, looking for those sorts of things, and their eye isn't keyed in on forage. Once you start paying attention to deer forage, how much you have, what the deer are eating, what species are there, you get an eye for this sort of thing. And now browse lines, when they're there, become very apparent. So it takes some adjustment to get your eye tuned to look for it. But when you have a browse line in the woods where deer have eaten everything from as high as they can reach to the ground, and it's literally like, you know, a fire has gone through or a razor has come by and cut off everything green from there to the dirt, that's not good. That is not a sign. What that says is you have way more deer than you have deer food. And, you know, it should not look like that. Now, when you have this kind of imbalance, you know, picture a scales, and you've got, there was actually a diagram we did with this article that shows deer in the scale on one side and forage in the other side of the scale. And so what's going on with the browse line is you've got a whole lot of deer, their scale is tipped down and no forage, and that's tipped up. Mm-hmm. To fix this situation, you can reduce deer numbers through doe harvest, reducing the weight on the deer side of the scale, but you can also do habitat improvement techniques that improve the amount of natural forage out there, increasing the amount of food on the food side, bringing you back to balance. So in that situation, yes, you should be taking more does, but you should also be looking for ways to increase the food. Again, it's a matter of deer numbers and food amount. You can increase or decrease, manipulate both sides of that equation until you get back to not seeing a browse line. If you're seeing a browse line in the woods, you want to stop seeing that. You want to see, you know, ample forage in a number of areas. In some ways, it takes sunlight on the ground to do that. In other ways, you can plant food plots to do that. There's a number of ways to improve and increase and encourage deer forage, but you need to be seeing deer forage that's not impacted.
Yeah, and you had you actually have a picture in the article, shows a perfect browse line behind this small buck. And I've seen browse lines on field edges. You know, those are easier for me to see, right? It looks like a farmer took a mower, you know, to the trees. And then sometimes I always question, why is there a browse line? Because it's on the edge of a bean field. And, you know, like they've got all the beans they want, the green, you know, when beans are growing, but yet they'll browse these trees to where it looks like a mower came through with a, or the farmer came through with a mower, and you know that farmer did not do that. So that is a browse line, you know, and it sometimes makes you wonder, are they, you know, are they just not in the mood to eat other things at the time? This is what they like, so they're just finishing it up and then moving on. Or it makes you think about the other thing. Do we have a food issue here or too many does? This is just another thing to think about. If we see browse lines like the one you picture in the article, or in the woods, I have a harder time noticing them in the woods for sure. You know, it could mean we got too many does.
You can see them, you know, you can see them anywhere. I went and visited a property recently that a friend had purchased locally, and he wanted me to come out and take a look with him, mm-hmm. and kind of evaluate the property for deer. And we first place we pulled up was this small field next to some woods, and there was a fence line going across the field there at the edge of a highway, and a bunch of Chinese privet had grown up in the fence line, which is an invasive non-native plant. And there was a browse line on the privet. Deer had been browsing that privet as high as they could reach, so there was a browse line on it. And when I looked at the rest of the property, it was solid, shady woods. So what's going on there is most of this deer property was shaded, mature forest with no understory. That offers almost nothing for deer to eat. If there's nothing growing in the understory and no sunlight getting through, there's no deer food out there except when acorns are falling. But for forage, which they need 365 days a year, there was nothing out there in those woods. The only forage they were finding was along edges and openings like that small field with a fence line where privet had grown up. The field itself was Bermuda grass or fescue. I forget exactly what it was, an old invasive pasture grass, which deer can't eat. Mm-hmm. And so Privet had sprung up in the fence line. That was the only forage they could reach. Privet is pretty poor forage anyway, but if it's all you got, that's what you're going to eat. If you know, if you don't have anything for supper and I give you a box of saltines, you know, it's not great supper, but you're going to eat it because you're hungry.
Yep.
And so that was an immediate red flag to me as we pulled on this property was, A, deer are eating privet. That's not good. B, there's a browse line on it. That's not good. And C, you know, the rest of the property was shady forest with no forage. So when you're seeing browse lines, you've got an imbalance between deer numbers and food.
And in that situation, you have two things you might deal with. You might have an overpopulation of does. That's very possible. You might have to look into that. And you also have a land management problem here that we need to start working on. You know, we need to open up the canopy. We need to get, you know, forage in the woods. And those might go hand in hand for sure. I mean, obviously, they're going to go hand in hand potentially. It's not always just one thing, but that is a sign for sure. So it's a good point. And you got an awesome picture of one in the article. If people hit the link and go read the article online, there's an awesome picture of a buck walking. And then right behind that buck, you've got a browse line that's 60, 70 yards wide across the edge of the field.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about that photo is I think most of the trees along that tree line are oaks, which you can tell from sort of the fall color.
Right.
Yep. And mature oak leaves are not great deer forage. So again, they're eating poor forage because it's all they've got.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And then, I mean, the field he's in front of is a grass field, you know, some sort of grass. And then right what he walked through is some sort of browse, and it's all gone. It's all browsed down to nothing, which makes you think there's probably a browse line right where he walked past as well, that edge. So, yeah, for sure, they've got some deer out there.
Yeah.
But, okay, so next point.
So the next point in the article was older does in your doe harvest. If you've been taking does a few, you know, each year, and you pull jawbones on those does and, you know, get the basic age on those with a jawbone, and you're seeing a lot, high percentage of old does in that data set, that's a sign that you're under harvesting the doe population that's out there. In other words, your population consists largely of older deer rather than younger, new production. Now, you know, I just told you that last year I killed a 9.5-year-old doe and the year before an 8.5, but you know, that's not necessarily a good measure because I'm looking at a group of antlerless deer and trying to pick the oldest, most mature adult doe
right.
I can.
Yeah.
So, you know, what we're talking about here is if several people have been harvesting does and you've got 10 or whatever doe jawbones you're looking at for the season or more, and they're all 5.5+, and there's no ones and twos in the mix occasionally coming in, that's a sign that across the doe population, you've got mostly older does. If you look at a unbiased set of jawbones from a doe harvest, and there's some 1 and 2 year old does in there mixed in with some 4s and 5s, that's what you want to see. You want to see a good mix. Vice versa, if you look at that and it's all yearling and 2 year old does, you probably have over harvested the doe population. There's nothing out there that's older than 2 or 3. And that could be a red flag that you've gone a little too far in your doe harvest. So you want to see a cross section. You want to see does of different ages out there in that doe harvest. And if, you know, all you're seeing is 4s and 5s and 6 year old and plus does in that collection, you need to step it up until you're seeing some younger deer in the mix. And I think, you know, in the article, the guideline that we give at our deer steward classes is, you know, as long as your hunting effort, the man hours you're putting in per season in stands and fawn recruitments are about the same, then your doe harvest should include around 25 to 30% does that are 4.5 or older. You know, less than 20% is a sign of a really young population and you might be over harvesting does. More than 40% and you may be under harvesting them. So this is a, you know, goes back to the importance of pulling jawbones on the does you harvest. That's good information that can help you make decisions about deer management.
I was just getting ready to ask you that question. I think it would be a good idea. I keep going back to, you know, Andy's farm and, you know, the discussions we have about does there. And, you know, he's allowed my son to come out there. He's allowed, you know, a few other people that I know to come out to harvest does because, you know, he can only kill so much and he doesn't want to keep just killing does that he's going to donate or whatnot when he can have someone else come out and get, you know, meat for themselves, which I think is great. It's awesome. But, you know, two or three does got killed last year out there, and we don't know how old they are. So pulling those those jawbones or whatever, sending them off to places like Wildlife Labs or whoever else that does the aging will help you get those data points that you need. Otherwise, you're kind of assuming things. Like, you can look at a group of does and you can get an idea of who the old mature doe is sometimes. And, you know, other times it's harder to tell who the old girl is. But you really don't know. She might just be bigger than the rest of them and 3 years old. You know, is what it, I mean, everybody has that. I mean, look at human beings. I'm in my 40s and 5'7". There could be a guy in his 60s that is 6'6". I mean, that doesn't mean that I am more mature than him. He is. He's bigger as well. Or I guess I said that backwards. I could be young and big, and he could be old and small. He's still older than me. So, yeah, it doesn't always mean that. So that's a good point. I mean, and something, you know, we should look at doing a lot more of is aging deer.
Yeah, and let me point out that you don't have to send a tooth off to a seminum lab to get this information. You pull a jawbone, you know, and we've got resources on our website teach you how to do this, but you pull the jawbone, you can look at it using tooth replacement patterns and quickly put that jaw, any jaw, into one of three age groups. Either it's a fawn under, you know, a year of age, it's a yearling at 1.5, or it's 2.5 plus, you know, without even looking at wear, tooth wear, which can be subjective. You can just look at the tooth replacement patterns. Deer replace their teeth just like we do, where they're born with some temporary teeth that are replaced by permanent ones at certain predictable stages. And just looking at that pattern, quickly tell whether a deer is, you know, a fawn, a yearling, or two, or goes into that 2+ category. Mm-hmm. That's really all you need to know to gauge what we're talking about here in terms of the number of really old does that are in your harvest. And yeah, when we're talking about 5.5 plus, it's pretty extreme wear. It's pretty easy to spot.
Yeah.
You don't have to, you know, do any calculations or measurements or comparisons to look at a jawbone and go, okay, this deer is fully mature, 5.5 plus, and maybe really old.
Yeah.
So yeah, we can teach you how to do that. You don't necessarily have to send a tooth off. You do that when, like in the case of my two recent does that I knew from tooth wear were very old, and I wanted to know precisely how old they were. So I sent teeth off for those and found out one was 9, one was 8.
Yeah, and also, you know, using labs like that, it can help with the nostalgia of harvesting a doe. And what I'm trying to say by that is, okay, I went out and killed a Micah killed a buck last year that I measured at 178 and some change inches, right? That is a mature whitetail buck, big deer, awesome. And we can tell because his rack is what it is and his body. We didn't really necessarily need to find out how old he was because we knew he was mature. Well, with a doe, though, that's almost like a way that you can say, look at this 178 inch doe, right? You send her off, she's nine years old. I killed a 9 year old doe. You know how hard that was? That's no different than killing a 180-inch buck, right? But she doesn't have that rack to do that with. So, you know, that's a kind of a way to do that, get that nostalgia of harvesting a doe is by sending them off to get aged. I know Wildlife Labs is not expensive. Obviously, it takes a little bit of work to get some stuff done. You got to send stuff off, but it's not expensive to do. So it's another way for you to say, hey, listen, you know, for instance, what I'm trying to say is Micah kills a 178-inch buck last year, right? I go kill a really mature doe in an awesome hunt, too. Let's just say that's the two deer. One of us killed a deer that year. most people would look at that those two hunters' years and say, what? Who had the better year? They would say Micah. He killed the big buck. But if we bring back the, you know, the nostalgia of killing really mature does when they're available, I can say, listen, yeah, you killed a 6-year-old buck who's awesome, but I killed a 9-year-old doe. She just doesn't have a rack. That's a one form, one way you can do that, by sending those things off and spending a couple dozens of dollars and getting them aged. That's a good point, man. I mean, I would do it for sure, because if I'm going to pull a jawbone, well, why not just send in some teeth and find out, you know? If I'm going to go through the work of doing the stuff that you guys can teach, which is free and is awesome to get that information, a guy like me is going to go ahead and go the next step and send them off to places like Wildlife Labs. And I know there's other ones out there as well. But so, yeah, I mean, that's something I'll probably look at doing moving forward, is when I decide to, you know, try to harvest a doe and go after one, if I think she's pretty, pretty mature, you know, that's a way to put a feather in your cap. You know, I killed that's a 7-year-old doe. It's the oldest deer I've ever killed or whatever. That's cool.
Yeah. No, there is an aspect to this that, you know, use the word trophy if you want to, but, you know, look on the wall behind me. There's a buck back there, a European mount, and you can probably see his jawbones are hanging there with the mount. But he's a minimum aged 6.5 years old. And it was his age that made me extremely proud of that deer. And so the jawbones are part of the story. In fact, you know, while we're talking, these are the jawbones sitting here on my desk of my 9.5-year-old doe from last year. I saved those. Mm-hmm. The jaw from my 8.5-year-old doe is right over here on this bookshelf as well, on a ring. So I saved those things. Those are things that, you know, achievements that I'm proud of and that I like to share with folks and go, look at these jaw. This is the jaw of a 9.5-year-old doe. So that is, yeah, we need to consider age in the factor here behind, you know, the best deer hunting stories and most memorable hunts we have, because age is sort of the great equalizer. Some bucks have more antlers than others and some deer weigh more than others, but in terms of the challenge of hunting a deer, age, an older deer that has survived multiple seasons out there and multiple hunting seasons, and that's an achievement also that should be noted.
For sure. And you can make the argument. Now, killing a 9-year-old buck is hard. hard. But you could make the argument killing a 9-year-old doe is harder. Right? She has birthed how many fawns by then, you know, in her life. And she's had to worry about not only keeping herself alive, but fawns every year, and sometimes twins, maybe triplets every once in a while, during that time, where a buck only has to worry about keeping himself alive. Right? And then bucks get...
Yes, great point.
Even 9-year-old bucks get stupid once a year. You know, so
yep.
Does don't ever get stupid.
The other thing is that bucks get stupid during the rut, and does don't. Does never get stupid or drop their guard. They are always on high alert.
Right.
And yeah, an older doe like that, there is no sharper, more experienced, wiser deer in the woods, more, you know, difficult to fool than an old doe.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, that's a great point. All right, next one.
Okay, let's see. I think it was kidney fat.
Yep, I think so.
Another real easy one here to use. You know, when you harvest deer in the fall, doesn't matter if it's buck or doe, and you're field dressing them, you ought to be evaluating the amount of body fat in the body cavity. You know, there's fat under the hide, and that's good to see too, but the first place that fat accumulates and disappears from, or the last place that it disappeared from, is inside the body cavity in that pelvic region, you know, covering the tenderloins, but also gathering around the kidneys. So if you can't recognize the kidneys in the gut pile because they're encased in globs of fat, that is a good sign. If you have to remove a lot of fat to get to the tenderloins and cut them out, that is a good sign. That means that deer is in good shape in the fall going into winter and has ample body fat. You want to see fat all over, but at a minimum, that body cavity fat should be, you know, plentiful. So if you're seeing deer, buck or doe, where the kidneys are just kidneys, and you can look at them in your hand, and anybody would look at that and go, that's a kidney, because there's no fat on it, that is a warning sign. There is, again, going back to that balance thing between deer numbers and food, there's an imbalance there. There's not enough food. Deer ought to have fat-encased kidneys in the fall. Now, you will get some cases. In fact, that 6.5-year-old buck behind me on the wall, I killed him in December post-rut. He was worn down. He'd been rutting hard, and I killed him in a food plot. He was trying to feed up after the rut was over. His kidneys were pretty naked. There was not much fat on his kidneys. He had lost a lot of his body mass during the rut. So that isn't always a good indicator.
Right.
An old, you know, hard rutting, you know, with dark tarsal glands and wounds and scars. This buck actually had lost an eye in a fight. They're going to have been rutted down and may not have as much kidney fat immediately following the rut as you would hope to see. So again, use other indicators. If there are any younger bucks that are in the harvest, if there are does in the harvest, you want to be looking at all of them to evaluate that. If all the deer you see that have been killed by you or locally by others have very little fat around their kidneys and around the tenderloin area on the inside of the body cavity, that's a warning sign that you need to take more does and improve habitat quality, as we've talked about.
And you can add different, like you said, different layers. Let's say you harvest a doe, open her up, very little kidney fat, very little fat overall, and you find out she's 6.5 years old also. Oh, we might have too many does here. Not only is she old, she doesn't have much health. We could have a problem here. You know, you can use a lot of these 12 signs in hand. Oh, we got browse lines, we got non-fatty kidneys, and we got an old doe. You know, we could have a major issue with does here. So, yeah, good point. All right, yes. What's the next one here? Kidney fat, food plot cages?
Yeah, that's it. So if you plant food plots, you ought to put a wire cage called a browse enclosure in every food plot. You know, you can just go to the hardware store and buy a roll of fencing, cut it into a 10-foot strip and roll it into a loop and stake it down in the food plot where deer can't push it over. And what that does is close off a small circle of the food plot forage and prevent deer from eating it. And that becomes your gauge on browse pressure. And if over the course of the fall or the summer, whenever you're growing a particular food plot, if that cage fills up with forage and outside there's not much left, particularly if there's very little forage left outside that cage, that's a warning sign that at that point in the year and maybe all year, you don't have enough food for the number of deer. You know, you can do this outside food plots too. You can go into the woods and in an area where some sunlight is reaching the ground, put a cage up and come back later. And if that cage has filled up with native plants and natural forages and vines, and outside the cage you can't find those plants, again, that is a sign that there are too many deer for the available forage. So an easy one to do. If you grow food plots, you ought to have a cage in every food plot. That's just so simple to do that and use that information to manage your deer population better.
Yeah, and I've never...
You know, and if those cages are filling up, but outside there's nothing but dirt and deer tracks, you can plant more food plots. You can do habitat techniques to increase forage at the same time that you're taking more does to reduce the deer density.
Yeah, it's an easy way to gauge it. I never even had thought of that or seen that before. And that picture, I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, there's not a whole lot of grass. Once again, there's a photo. Not a whole lot of grasses or forage outside of the cage, and the cage is full of, looks like brassicas, radishes, whatever, you know, 2-2.5 foot tall. And then there's nothing outside.
Right.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. Quick visual, so easy to do. And one at a glance, you can see the situation. You know, ideally what you would see is that the forage in and out of the cage is roughly equal, or maybe there's only light forage pressure on the food outside the cage. That's actually a great sign. There's no problem with that. If people say, I can't hardly tell the deer are eating my food plot, that's okay. It means that, you know, you've got plenty of food to go around for the deer. They're not always going to be feeding in your food plots. If white oak acorns are falling, those are highly attractive. They're probably going to shift the pressure to those white oak acorns, and your food plot is going to be less attractive. So food plots shouldn't always be eaten to the dirt. It can be a very good sign of good deer health if there's ample forage outside and inside the cage.
Nice. That's a good point. Let's see. Next point. I don't even know what number we're on at this point. I kind of stopped counting. Deer are eating crap. I like
that. That's right. Going back to learning to eyeball habitat and eyeball forage and plant species, you know, you ought to learn the desirable deer forages. And what happens is once that's what they're going to choose first. And when the pressure on those drives those local plants into, you know, local extinction, they'll start choosing the second and third choice foods, eventually getting to the worst stuff. So when you're seeing them eat things, you know, and in most cases, it's going to be non-native plants like privet, like English ivy, mm-hmm. you know, you will see deer eat those. They're terrible forages. And when deer are eating them, it's a warning sign that they are down to the worst food. And sometimes even in winter, you will see deer eating, I've seen them eating red cedar needles. You know, you may have seen that where they're browsing red cedar. You know, when they're doing that, there's just not enough quality forage. Now, winter is a special time. There's not enough food anyway. But what they rely on in winter is dormant browse, woody browse, the branches and tips and buds of dormant shrubs and plants. That's what they eat. And when those are not abundant enough, that's when they'll start eating cedar needles and non-native plants like privet and English ivy and other things. So you can still have quality winter browse through habitat management that prevents them from having to eat these poor quality non-native plants. You know, now deer hunters in the north, again, it's a unique situation. It's not unusual for deer in the north to rely on conifer needles in winter, particularly in yarding areas where they yard up to survive the most extreme winter weather.
Mm-hmm.
But still, you don't want them relying on conifer needles completely to get through winter, even in those situations. Even in the north, you should be doing enough habitat management to ensure young forest cover, early successional cover that produces that dormant winter browse that is mostly what they rely on. Deer get through winter on that fat supply, that fat, they burn that fat as an energy supply, and then they browse on the winter forage to fill their stomach with that to supplement the fat as an energy supply. So you want them eating quality dormant winter browse, not 100% conifer needles. So yes, they'll do that, and they'll especially do that more in the north, but it doesn't mean that deer eating conifer needles is a good thing or normal thing, and that's what they should be surviving on.
Yeah.
So again, wherever you are, learning to identify this and seeing signs in the south, if you're seeing deer eating red cedars or eating privet or eating English ivy or eating other non-native species like that, multiflora rose and others that we can name, that's a warning sign.
Good point. Now, this next point, we kind of touched on it already, but with, you know, rattling and grunting, but the next point is the rut is a dud. You know, the rut should not be a dud.
No, and that includes, as I said in the article, everything from scrapes and rubs to seeing bucks chase does to maybe every now and then witnessing a buck fight to hearing bucks grunt as they chase does. All of these things that we like to see are indicators of a healthy rut with competition. In a healthy deer population, there is competition among bucks to breed. That's why they scrape. That's why they rub. That's why they travel. That's why they chase. It's why they grunt. It's why they vocalize. It's why they fight with each other, is to earn the right to be the one to breed an estrus doe. And when the rut happens, it's in a fairly short window. It should be an intense competition for bucks to achieve that. So beyond just, you know, rattling and grunt calls working are these other signs that we love to see. Even if you don't call to deer with a grunt call or rattling, don't we all love to see a buck chase a doe by, even if it's a yearling buck, even if it's a six or you know, small buck that we're not going to harvest that day. We like to see that. That makes a hunt so exciting. You know, getting to witness two bucks fight or even spar with each other is an exciting day in the woods. Hearing bucks grunt, witnessing fights, all of that makes deer hunting so exciting. And when you're not seeing that, that is a sign, again, that the rut is just not very intense where you are. It means does outnumber bucks, and doe harvest will help.
And, I mean, it's going back to what we talked about with the bachelor, right? If there's one buck for 30 does, we don't need to fight. We don't need to produce scrapes and all that crap, because they're all right here in my backyard. I just walk out here and pick which one I want to breed. And, you know, there's another buck over there with 30 does. He's got his 30, and he won't be able to get to all of them by the end of it anyways. So, you know, we don't need to fight. We don't need to worry about it. We just go do our thing. So it makes a great point. And it makes the rut bad in other areas. Calling, all those things are going to get worse if they don't have to fight or work at breeding. I mean, it's kind of common sense when you think about it that way.
Yes.
Next one would be non-native plants rule, I think.
Yep. So again, learning to evaluate your habitat out there. Look, we've all got non-native plants where we hunt. They're all there once you learn to spot them. The different species that dominate vary depending on where you're located, but we've all got them. And if once you learn to spot them, if they're common, if they dominate openings, you know, the few openings or what openings you have where you hunt, in edges of food plots, fields, logging decks, road shoulders, whatever it is, you know, thin timber, whatever it is that is where sunlight reaching the ground. If non-native plants are dominating there, that's trouble. And the reason is because what I said before, generally deer don't use or eat non-native plants. And that really, the problem that's going on here is they're eating native plants that they prefer. So the native plants are not only having to defend themselves against being browsed, they're competing with the non-native plants that nothing is using.
Yeah.
So the non-native plants have all the advantages in this fight, and that's why they come to dominate these openings. And when they dominate these openings, it means you've got the lowest quality food for available for deer dominating openings. And those openings could be higher quality forage for deer. So, you know, if you can control these plants, can you eradicate them? No, in many cases, you know, this seems like a fight you can't win. But you certainly can control them, manage them, and everyone that you kill, and you know, is going to be replaced by native plants that deer will use. So working to control those where you hunt will switch the mix back toward native plants that deer use and increase the deer forage. In the South, you know, we've got privet, we've got multiflora rose, a lot of the others, we've got English ivy, we've got a ton of them, cogon grass, we can go through the list. In the North, in the Midwest, you've got autumn olive and multiflora rose and others that come to dominate.
Yep.
Some of these deer will eat like privet when worse comes to worse, but most of them they won't even touch and will not eat. And so controlling these allows you to encourage plants they will eat, and that's what you want to do to increase deer forage. So again, if you look out there and see a whole lot of non-native plants, you don't have much deer food. And so staying on top of doe harvest is going to be important until you increase the native deer forage.
Are most and you may not know the exact answer here, but are most invasive species not good for deer to eat? Or do they just not prefer most of them? I mean, obviously, like things we've talked about aren't good for them, but are there any of them like, actually, that's full of nutrients, but they just don't like it because it's not what they're wired to eat? It just seems like most invasives aren't good for them too. It's like it's a shit plant generally, no matter what.
That's right. Generally, most of them are poor quality forage. They are low in protein, high in low in digestibility, high in acid detergent fiber, which means they're not easily digestible, and that's why deer don't select them until they are forced to. Now, not everyone, of course, there's Japanese honeysuckle, which deer love to eat. There is now Japanese honeysuckle, to your point, is still not high quality deer forage. It's not high in protein, but deer will browse it. Kudzu is another one deer will browse.
Might like that, the taste, but not necessarily great for them
readily. Right.
Yeah,
it's still not the best. The point is you can do better. you can do better than kudzu and Japanese honeysuckle. So just because deer will eat something doesn't mean you can't do better. And in the case of non-natives, it's always better to have native plants there, even if it's a species like honeysuckle that deer will use.
Gotcha.
So, yep. So yeah, it's there's a little of both. There are some non-native plants that are better. They're not great, but they're better in terms of forage. But most of them are very poor forage, and deer won't eat them until they're forced to. You know, this is something people need to learn about deer is deer don't die of starvation. They right. die of malnutrition. And when they die of malnutrition, you'll find them with a full stomach. Their stomach will be full. It will just be full of the worst stuff left, the most indigestible, least valuable plants yeah. and plant parts that was remaining in the habitat.
Kind of like a honeysuckle is kind of like a Jolly Rancher. Tastes great, horrible for my teeth, does nothing for me, right? Sounds like it is.
That's right.
Right. Okay, right. Internal parasites being abundant. And I think that one, and then there's one or two more, and that's the 12 signs, I think. So, yeah, internal parasites.
Yeah, just an easy one. You know, just like me and you, when our health is lower, when we're in poor health, we are more susceptible to infection from viruses and, yes, parasites and other things that are attacking us from outside our body. When your, you know, natural defense and immune mechanisms are not at their peak power, you're more susceptible to infection. Deer are the same way. And so when they have inadequate forage and the deer population is less healthy on the whole, they're more vulnerable to parasites, and parasites become plentiful. They flourish in unhealthy deer. And so when you're opening up deer and you're encountering abdominal worms, you know, lung worms, you'll see liver flukes in the liver. There's meningeal worms. There's just a whole host, stomach worms. There's a host of animals you might come across when you're field dressing a deer. And if you're seeing that commonly, that's a sign your deer are in poor health.
Yep, that's a good, and we've all seen it. We've all opened a deer up and like, what the freaking hell is all over his lungs or whatever? And, you know, you take pictures and send it to your buddies and they're like, ooh, nasty, you know, or whatever. You know, now some of them, like, yeah. we've all opened bucks up before that had an injury that got infected, and so there was a big pus ball, you know, inside of that. That's different. But every once in a while, you open one up and you're like, that's gross, but it is what it is. Ticks, the worst thing in the history of mankind.
Yeah. Yeah, ticks can be an indicator. If you're seeing a lot of deer really crusted with ticks, I don't mean you saw a tick on a deer that you harvested. I mean, this is, you know, repetitive. And in trail camera photos, you can see ticks on the ears of deer or on the antlers of deer. Mm-hmm. You see fawns with ticks encrusted around the eyes. If this is a common thing, that's a good sign deer are out of balance with the habitat and that you've got too many deer. And the reason is because deer are a host in the tick life cycle. And the more hosts there are out there for ticks, the more ticks can reproduce and the more they flourish. But also at the same time, you've got that health factor again, like we were talking about, where deer just aren't as able to fight off attacks from parasites like ticks and internal parasites as well, and infectious diseases and viruses. So again, this is another sign. And you know what I pointed out in the article, the thing I love about ticks is you can manage them two ways. One is doe harvest to keep deer in balance with the habitat, but also prescribed fire, which is my favorite habitat management technique.
Just getting ready to bring that up.
Fire, yep. Of course. Yeah, fire torches ticks. And if deer density is in control, after a fire, if deer density is down, you know, where it needs to be, and ticks don't have a overabundance of hosts for their reproductive cycle, you are going to knock a dent in tick numbers locally. At my family's land in South Georgia, where I hunt, where we keep the deer population in balance with the habitat and where we use prescribed fire regularly, I never find ticks on me. Not even in turkey season when I'm sitting down in the brush leaning against trees. We don't have a problem with ticks there. So, you know, this is why Lyme disease is so abundant and such a problem in people in the Northeast, yeah. in places like Connecticut and New York and other places where you've got a lot of urban areas where Hunting has been excluded, but deer populations are still dense. There's plenty of tick hosts for their life cycle, and lots of poor habitat, and lots of unhealthy deer.
And no fire. Yeah, well, we have a partner. His name's Dustin. He is a land manager. He does that sort of stuff for a living. And he almost every time you ask him, what should we do, his answer is fire. Start with fire, you know, and then we go from there. And, you know, there's just not as much fire as there used to be. We don't set fire, you know, we don't set fires. Sounds horrible. Sounds like I'm a pyro. But, you know, we don't do it as much as we used to. It's making a comeback because people like him are smart and they're, you know, saying to do this to people and people listen. But, I mean, you just don't see fire like you used to back in the day where it controlled things like cedars, you know, that used to just be found in areas that fire didn't reach or whatever. But now even invasive species take over, ticks, you know, all those things. So, yeah, that's a good point. And definitely an animal. I don't understand why it even exists, but it does. And then I think the last point is you hunt in a CWD management zone, which thankfully I don't at the moment.
Yeah, I don't either. And if you don't, be thankful. But there are growing numbers of hunters who hunt in areas where chronic wasting disease has been discovered in the deer. And, you know, Missouri has a number of these, as you know, a number of CWD management zones. And other states do as well. You know, we're now 33 or 34 states, I think. I've lost track of the number of states that have found CWD in localized areas in deer. So you should know if you hunt in a CWD management zone, and if you do, follow the guidance of the state wildlife agency and help them achieve their doe harvest goals. You're not trying to wipe out the deer. You're simply trying to maintain balance between deer and their habitat to keep them in healthy condition, because CWD spreads faster in an overpopulated deer situation, because the deer are simply, you know, this is a disease that spreads deer to deer. And when there are more deer bumping into each other more often, the disease is going to spread faster. So balancing the deer with their habitat not only increases deer health on an individual and population level, but it slows the deer-to-deer spread of the disease. So staying on top of doe harvest, and of course, if you're in the zone, getting every deer you harvest tested for CWD to help with the monitoring effort is very important. You know, it's again, we're not saying shoot every doe you can. There still should be a goal of does for you to harvest, and you're trying to hit the right number. You're not trying to take every doe.
Right.
You're trying to hit the right number to maintain balance. All these other signs we've talked about still matter in a CWD zone. It's just more important than ever in that zone to follow those indicators and to follow the guidance of your wildlife agency to help them achieve their harvest quota that they want to hit in that zone for testing and for maintaining a healthy deer population.
Awesome. And those are the 12 signs. That's the article. You know, we basically did it in podcast form just now. But if you want to read the article, which I would highly suggest, there's good pictures and other things that Lindsay mentions in the article that we didn't talk about specifically. We'll link it in the show release, but then also go to National Deer Association website and you can read the article, among others, that Lindsay and others have written for them. So, Lindsay, tell them where they can find the National Deer Association on social media, things like that, and then I'll let you off the hook for this one.
So, yeah, we're at deerassociation.com is our website. All of our social media is at Deer Association is our handle. We're on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and even Twitter. So at Deer Association is where you'll find us. And if you go to a browser and type in deerassociation.com/articles, you'll go straight to all of our most recent articles, and this one will be near the top. It was published on August 21.
Yep.
So you can always go there and pick up our most recent stories. We've got newer ones since that one came out. The other thing, too, is I'd urge you to go to deerassociation.com/join, and join as a free basic member. It doesn't cost you anything, and you'll be signed up for our newsletter, which we send out every Thursday morning by email. And that will include our latest articles, latest podcast episodes, latest videos, events that are coming up, ways to get involved with us. The newsletter is the best way to plug in to the National Deer Association.
For sure. And if you're feeling really lazy, just go to Google and type in 12 signs you should start harvesting more does. It'll take you straight to it. That's another easy way to do it. I literally just did it as we were recording because I forgot to bring it up before we started. So Lindsey Thomas Jr., cousin, which is not true. People out there should know we are not related as far as we know. Although my family is originally from Georgia, just saying. But not that family. it's a long Native American thing here. But yeah, man, I appreciate you coming on. We are not related as far as we know, but we're going to make the joke every time we talk. And I appreciate your time and good luck this season harvesting does and bucks alike, man.
I appreciate it, Nate. And hey, it's just like, you know, we've all got a little Neanderthal genetics in us. You and I've got some Thomas in us.
We got something somewhere.
Yep. It's good to see you, cuz. Thank you.
All right, we'll talk to you later.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.